You are indeed. And we're about to take a trip into the future. Very interesting guest, Dr. James Canton, PhD, is a renowned global futurist, social scientist, author, and sought-after business advisor. For the past 25 years, he has been insightfully forecasting the impact of future trends and innovations on business, customers, and society. He is the chairman and CEO of the Institute for Global Futures, which is an internationally recognized San Francisco think tank, which he founded in 1990 to help clients better anticipate the future. Dr. Canton advises Fortune 1000 corporations and governments worldwide. Dr. Canton advises the National Science Foundation. He is a senior fellow at the Center for Research in Technology and Innovation at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. He also served as an advisor to the White House Office of Science and Technology, Motorola, and MIT's Media Lab, Europe. His newest book is entitled The Extreme Future. In a moment, Dr. Canton. All right, just before getting to Dr. Canton, Chuck K. Well, actually, I shouldn't give his call letters. In Sedona, Arizona, a friend of mine actually cleared this up for me regarding 20 meters and why it opens at night. He says, "Art, in equatorial regions, that would be here, a significant amount of ionization remains after dark, and daytime ionization makes for a really absorptive D layer. What you're seeing is rather normal for this time of year in that part of the sunspot cycle where you are," meaning here near the equator. And speaking of the equator, just back from also near the equator is Dr. James Canton. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I understand you are severely jet lagged, having just flown back from Indonesia. Is that correct?
Singapore and China, but
Oh, Singapore and China.
I'm good to go. I'm good to go.
Well, as you know, I'm in Manila in the Philippines, so I know how long a plane trip it is. You sound pretty good for having made that trip.
Well, I live on Krakatoa time, so.
All right, you are an extreme futurist. Now, how does an extreme futurist differ from your normal everyday run-of-the-mill futurist?
Well, the book is called The Extreme Future. I would say that I am a futurist that covers all ranges of forecasts. This particular book is, of course, about the extreme future, which does have within it a variety of extreme forecasts covering a number of subjects I assume we'll be talking about.
All right, well, let's get to it. There sure is plenty to talk about, and let's begin with oil. Oil is, I guess, the reason we have wars, some wars now, and we'll have many, many more wars with regard to it in the future. There's a group of people out there, doctor, who think that it's kind of like it's never going to end. That the oil wells are filling back up, and Mother Earth is replenishing the oil wells with oil, and therefore, there is no such thing as peak oil, and we're not going to run out of oil. Do you want to dispense with that one now?
Yes, at some point we will run out of oil. The only question is, how long? And I have a forecast for that in my book. I talk about. I think, and again, the best way to talk about this is to give you not just what we think is a forecast, but of course the folks that control, a lot of that oil, which is the Saudis. In a private meeting, we went ahead and reviewed with the Saudis and other parties on two occasions, both in the U.S. government and around the world. And the general consensus that I take away from is that 25 to 30 years is the horizon for what we still think is the abundance of oil. But I believe that it will eventually, if it doesn't go away, it will become very expensive. The really interesting phenomena is that the necessity of the next generation of breakthroughs is going to be born over the next, again, 3 to 5 years. You're going to see breakthroughs, and these breakthroughs may become more efficient, more effective than oil as a fuel source. And that's what's going to drive all of this, not just the abundance issue. If you get outside of that, there's other things to talk about.
Okay, well, all right, let's talk about breakthroughs. Do you have any clues for us where these breakthroughs are likely to come?
Absolutely. There's three areas that are very important. One is you're going to see a breakthrough in hydrogen right away. Now, everybody's been waiting for this. This is kind of like the conversation around the human genome. If you're in life sciences or you're a scientist who's been tracking any of this or just a general consumer, right up to the mapping of the human genome, which is a fairly new phenomena, the best case scenarios were, gee, it was going to happen somewhere north of, 2010, 2015, maybe 2020.
That's
and,
right.
Of course, once you got the private sector involved, then you all of a sudden accelerated this time frame. And, of course, lo and behold, within 3 years, the genome was mapped. The same thing is going to happen here with energy. So solar voltaics, nano energy, and hydrogen are three technology areas we can talk about. There's going to be breakthroughs in. People are working on them. You're going to see a big, I think, breakthrough in each of these, starting with solar voltaics very shortly. I've just come back, as you mentioned, from China and a meeting in Hong Kong. I was happy to hear about a new solar technology that's being developed, produced in China, U.S. innovation, and will be available to be able to grow that business very quickly, just one of dozens of innovations. And, of course, other kind of, on the edge, extreme innovations yet to be fully worked out are things such as, nanotechnology and its relationship, nanosolar or nano energy for the next generation, the ability to manipulate matter at the atomic level to make, if you will, new kinds of energy sources. Sounds science fiction, but I think it's not.
Do you have any specifics on this solar voltaic breakthrough in China? What is the change?
Well, the change is inexpensive solar panels, very super efficient technology to be able to convert to electricity, and a lot more, again, leveraging off of low cost manufacturing in China and Yankee innovation together. With, again, just the benefit being us all the beneficiaries of Moore's Law. As Moore's Law, progresses, we're going to be beneficiaries in things that are smaller, smarter, more powerful for a fraction of the cost. That's inevitably, as we live longer, we're going to be able to benefit from any of these breakthroughs. So solar voltaics are going to be able to give us higher yield efficiencies, meaning more power from the sun, if you will.
Well, that's certainly going to be important. I've heard that, talking about hydrogen for a moment, that there are some holes in the whole hydrogen idea. In other words, it takes energy to create and then store the hydrogen as we currently understand it. So it's not exactly the great winner, according to some people, that it's been ballyhooed to be.
Well, that's true. And, Art, I drove in a Honda hydrogen car, and it was a very strange experience because we were on the highway, and there was no noise. There was no engine. And the only exhaust was water. Now, that car is $1.2 million today. But again, and when I was last in China and I met with the president of GM China, I asked him about this question about, are they working on hydrogen? Where will it come from? He couldn't tell me exactly, but I think it's somewhat of a secret that they're working on things in China. If it happens first, it'll probably happen there. I think you're going to see, again, within the next half a decade here, you're going to see breakthroughs in hydrogen fuel cells. And you're right. Up to this point, we've needed a lot of carbon, a lot of petrol energy to be able to make hydrogen. There are going to be, again, the secret is the convergence of these technologies together, nanobio and solar, for instance, nanobio and hydrogen. It's the secret to solving most of the problems, which I talk about in my book, The Extreme Future, is based on us being able to take a more systems approach to solving these problems with convergent technologies, and particularly in the area of energy. And I'll relate one particular story in a meeting with government officials, Secretary Abraham, before he left as Secretary of Energy. He made it very clear that the government knows at the highest levels that there's not enough energy in the ground or alternatives to be able to sustain GDP, that's growth, for the United States or any other countries unless we discover new sources. Now, that's both existing, you know, oil, it's certainly nuclear, and it's absolutely new alternatives like hydrogen that are and have to be developed.
Okay. Doctor, maybe you can explain this to me. I was in Hong Kong, a month and a half ago or so, 2 months ago, actually, to be specific. And if you go up into the new territories north of Hong Kong, the amount of industry up there just scares the hell out of you. Their economy is going crazy. Now, we come up with technological ideas, and they immediately go to China where they're produced and then exported. Now, a lot of people wonder how that bodes for the U.S. economy. We have the ideas, but they're produced and then marketed and distributed from China. Now, how does the U.S. economy survive that in the long term?
Great question. First of all, it's the intimate linkage globally of economies that's already occurred. So let's just talk about the China. You've asked about the China-U.S. linkage. There's a fundamental linkage that's already occurred, a kind of what I call, you know, global economic intimacy between the United States and China. China holds, one of the key reasons why their economy is stable and growing is because they're holding over $1 trillion worth of U.S. treasuries and currencies. So they've used that as a hedge against, you know, a currency that is not convertible, number one. Number two, if you were to take away Walmart's purchasing alone, all right, this is the largest retail establishment in the world. If you were to take away their purchasing alone, meaning buying their 90% of their products from China, you'd probably see the Chinese economy crash, just that alone, number one. And the next really is that we benefit, and here's the bottom line. The U.S. economy actually has grown the manufacturing sector, but it's the higher end of the manufacturing sector. It's your higher innovation. In my chapter on the innovation economy, and I talk about this, if you're concerned about jobs disappearing here, I don't think you need to be. We can't fill over 1 million high-tech jobs today in the economy that go lagging. That will grow to be almost 10 million within a decade and change. So the issue is one, a very large growing global economy, and two, this intimacy between China and the U.S. economies where we're linked in a fundamental way, and I think it's a productive thing. And three, it's the higher innovation industries in the U.S., more IP, nanobio, neuro, IT, of course, but it's the higher level innovation industries where manufacturing is not going to go away. In other words, as the innovation bar gets raised higher and higher here in the United States, there will still be a robust manufacturing sector, but it will transform. So there's enough to go around for everybody. This is not it's not a scarcity of ideas or innovation that's going to drive the global economy.
Well, is Japan a good bellwether for it? In other words, Japan went through what China's going through now and ended up holding a lot of U.S. dollars, buying a lot of U.S. property. We all got really scared about Japan, and then the whole scare shifted to China. Now, the world didn't end because Japan produced a lot of goods that we bought, and you're saying the same thing is going to end up being true of China.
Absolutely, even more so. Now, Japan has a number of problems that they never resolved, and for instance, as we look at things, the Institute for Global Futures, there sometimes what you don't invest in or what you don't cure ends up becoming, you know, let me give you an example. For instance, Japan is making the largest investments in robots and androids, okay? Now, that's going to benefit the whole world, but particularly it's going to benefit Japan, where they're really anti-immigration, they're a very, you know, monocultural society, and it's a society that's not growing. People are not, you know, it's depopulating, okay? But for all intents and purposes, there are some similarities. Americans have to kind of get over this Sino fear that they have about whether first, you're right, it was Japan and now it's China being kind of ending our world. I just think that's one, it's wrong thinking. It's limited mindsets. And two, I think that the Chinese have so many issues, so many problems to deal with, that it's not like, I mean, you've got to remember our economy and their economy are growing very robustly. Their economy may be growing more, but this is still the largest economy in the world, the United States.
And you feel that it will remain so, even though so much manufacturing is going on in China and we're the consumers of the great majority of that. You think we'll still maintain our position?
Again, there are danger signals that I report on in the book. We've done a number of studies which confirm some of the work that's been done at the National Science Foundation and other leading authorities, which would indicate, as we would agree, that unless the United States continues to kind of get over this anti-science phenomena and reinvest in advanced technology, reinvest in science, research and development, both at, you know, in academics, private sector support, and of course research and government, unless we reinvest at a higher level than we have been, then we could be at risk. Because, again, if you put these two things together, it's raising the innovation bar. Well, if you're going to do that, you've got to invest in technologies and pure science now to get the products. All of the major breakthroughs that have driven the world for the past 20 years have come out of investments led by the United States, if you will. You know, computing, the internet, certainly nanotechnology, materials. I was the first private sector advisor to the National Nanotechnology Initiative when it was called the Interagency Working Group on Nano. Again, this has led to a very robust $10 billion marketplace, but also it's led to many countries investing in this. We, America, must lead on innovation and continue to be on the leading edge. And I talk about that in my book. It's very critically important. If we don't renew that investment, Art, we're going to be in trouble. We're going to be in trouble in terms of jobs, the economy, quality of life. And I think that
how soon?
Will be difficult.
How soon?
Well, again, if we don't do it, I think that you're going to see within 3 to 5 years, and certainly within 10 years, you'll see quality of life will be hurt. You'll see economic competitiveness will be hurt. Already it's happening now. I mean, that's kind of one of the dirty little secrets about outsourcing. It's not just that, you know, all of the major technology companies and now financial service companies are outsourcing jobs because, you know, you can get an engineer for a fraction of the price or somebody to do your, you know, particular research. It's because you can't find the talent here. You can't get them in. Remember, what's grown the U.S. economy has been immigration, and particularly smart immigrants who came here, studied here, and stayed here. If we don't have that flow, if we don't invest in education at the highest levels, we're building a future where our children and grandchildren will not be living the kind of prosperity that we enjoy today.
Well, we're certainly not science-oriented right now. There's no question about it. And the U.S. educational system, if you look at it, has fallen quite considerably over the last many years compared, you know, in world surveys. It's actually a little frightening. Somebody told me about it, and I said, no, you're full of it. The U.S. has always been number one. No, we're not.
Well, you know, that's true to a certain extent. There are other factors at play, and it's not as if you can't turn that around, okay? So,
right.
And we must turn it around, and that's one of the central theses of my book and many other voices as well. I'm not the only futurist or person who's led this charge. It's now become, I think, on everybody's radar, and I think we can turn it around. There's something else about Americans, though, that we tend to be very entrepreneurial. We tend to be able to, you know, embrace change and make changes fairly quickly. And I think, don't forget that our productivity is higher than any place else in the world. We may not be having as long vacations and not have the quality of life of the Europeans, if you will, but there is something to be said about our ability to make money, be entrepreneurs, start new businesses, you know, and exploit innovation, if you will. I don't see that necessarily going away, but I do think that this, you're right, this fundamental science investment is a hedge against the future where it will be a lot more complex. Challenges.
Oh, you're exactly right. We're at the bottom of the hour, Doctor. Hold it right there. And he's right. If you go to Europe, for example, they take 5 and 6 week vacations. I spent some time in France, and it certainly is a beautiful country, and Paris is a beautiful city, but Well, I tell you, you look around France and you wonder how anything ever gets done because nobody's working. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell. It is, and Dr. James Canton, a futurist who's written a book called The Top 10 Trends of the Extreme Future. Now, we've only made it through one. We've talked about fuel, energy, oil, and alternatives there, too, a little bit. But if we're going to make it through all 10, we're going to have to hurry. So in a moment, once again, Dr. Canton. How long do you want to live? Over the years, I've interviewed a number of longevity medicine physicians, and it's been fascinating what they've had to say and offer us. Dr. Canton, what do you see in longevity medicine? It is a fascinating area.
Well, this is an unprecedented time for longevity because this is the first time that we have the ability to be able to look into the mechanism of how life extends, begins, where disease begins. You realize up to this point in time, it's really been a crapshoot in terms of understanding what is the mechanism and being able to look into DNA and being able to understand your particular DNA and how it influences your health. Your forecast for your life. We're going to have these tools right now. Probably the biggest part of this revolution is the convergence of course, genomics with healthcare. You realize healthcare is pretty dumb today. You wait until you have a lump or you have a problem. You go to the doctor. The doctor takes some tests. At the end of the day, it's a very imprecise practice. Having the capacity to be able to look into your genomic profile where we can then predict and prevent will make for an entirely revolution in life extension. And that's
just
not
one problem.
We have to wait for.
Yeah, one problem, though. You said predict and then prevent. Well, there's going to be a big chasm there, and we're going to be able to, unfortunately, predict long before we can prevent. And so you're going to have a situation where they can look at your DNA and they can essentially say, look, at 51 years old, you're going to get some sort of incurable cancer. Now, the day will come when we can cure that cancer, but that day is not today. So if an insurance company gets hold of that information, my God, the economy will go topsy-turvy because, well, obviously.
Well, you already have started to see that happen, and you're absolutely right. We could screen all the women in the world and determine, you know, where they stand in terms of two very prevalent breast cancers. We could do a test right now and determine, you know, when you might have the beginnings of Alzheimer's. One out of three men over the ages of 70 are at risk for Alzheimer's. So you're absolutely right. There's going to be this gap between being able to know what the potential risks are and then, of course, being able to cure them. But that's where we are. This is the Middle Ages. This is not the Renaissance that's coming in terms of healthcare. Now, the issue that you talked about in terms of medical privacy, this is a very big issue. In my chapter on the invisible war in the book, I go into these issues. And inevitably, you're going to end up with, given the degree of security that's on the planet today, somebody's going to have a look at your genomic history, and it will influence your privacy.
That's right. And so here's a good question for you. How much of a gap are we talking about between when we can predict when these diseases are going to strike and when we're going to be able to cure them? How many years are we talking about here?
Well, I believe within a decade that cancer will be an issue of disease management. I believe we will be able to manage cancer as a disease that will not kill people, will not destroy their, you know, their lives and their families, but we'll be able to manage it with drugs, manage it with medical devices. The very fast emergence, again, this convergence of nanobio, IT, and cognitive science, these are the four key what I call them, the four key innovation tools that will drive this transformation in healthcare and, of course, life extension. And I believe that, again, some of these, and this is just the ugly truth, we're going to have a lot more information than we're going to have cures. But there's new areas, translational medicine, systems biology, synthetic biology. There's big breakthroughs in using supercomputing to be able to better do predictive analysis. So I'm going to say within 3 to 5 years for certain kinds of treatments, particularly related to cancer, but then within 8 to 10 years, cancer will be a managed disease. People can live with it.
That's very interesting. When you say a managed disease with respect to cancer, do you mean managed, for example, in the sense that AIDS is now managed?
That's correct. Exactly.
How do we afford it, doctor? You know, AIDS is managed all right, and I think on average you can expect to live 24 years after diagnosis or something like that as the latest, but my God, at $100,000+ in cost per year per patient. So if we manage cancer in the same way, who can afford it?
Well, this is, again, this is the other part of all of this. The other part of all of this is that the cost of who pays, who gets the medicines, and then, of course, the other flip side of this is who gets enhanced. We haven't gotten to that part of the life extension phenomena, which, of course, is the post-human and human enhancement and you know, designed evolution. But let's save that in a moment and address this question because it's a legitimate one. I think you're going to have, particularly in, you know, democratic societies, you're going to have challenges where you're going to have to subsidize a certain amount of this care. And this is not something that individuals will be able to necessarily afford. And there's going to be huge social and ethical imbalances until we work this out. But this is an area where government is going to have to step up, and there's going to be much more opportunities for partnership between the private sector, certainly, and governments to enable and enhance. And let me put this together with the earlier trend we talked about in terms of shifts in the workforce and depopulation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Governments are going to need to enhance the well-being and health and the longevity of their citizens because, one, we are going to be, again, the two drags on growth, if you will, and security and certainly productivity in the future are going to be people and energy, okay? So, okay. Of course, how do you deal with energy? We talked about that, but how do you deal with people? Well, help enhance them, live them longer. Now, governments are just beginning to wake up to this now, and I'm doing my part to get them to wake up so they can enhance the health of their citizens. So they're going to pay more because it's going to be the interest to have people live longer, be productive members of society. Places like Japan, for instance, you could have 10 people left in Japan by 2050.
God.
I mean that metaphorically. People are not having babies there. They have no immigration there. They really have major challenges. There's a bounty if you're willing to get married, for instance, in Japan. You know, there's more people leaving Japan than coming, you know, anyplace else. For instance, in Italy alone, there's more people on the dole, right? And there's more people in pensions than there are working in the workforce. They cannot exist in Italy and much of Europe without opening up the arms to immigration. Well, you're going to have to enhance people's longevity, or you're not going to have enough people.
Yeah, that's absolutely all right. Let's move on to enhancement. That's a fascinating word. When you say enhancement, human enhancement, you mean what?
Well, there's different kinds of enhancement. So in the book, The Extreme Future, I break it down to a couple of areas. There's three different key phases. One phase is where we rejuvenate. You know, we heal, we fix. You had a disease or you're born blind or, you know, you've got a problem with your hearing. We're going to fix that. You've got, you know, cancer. We're going to fix that. Or we're going to prevent that cancer from ever happening by turning on or turning off genes. Okay, that's fixing. That's the first phase. The second phase is we're going to go ahead and enhance certain capabilities. It's augmentation. You know, we're going to go ahead, for instance, and you know, you'd like to, for instance, have a you'd have to have total recall in terms of your memory. Or you'd like to be able to learn a language in an afternoon. Or perhaps you'd like to go ahead and have super memories, okay? So it's not just fixing, it's now enhancing cognition, enhancing maybe intelligence, okay?
How far are we from that kind of ability?
Oh, we're there. We're already there. That's the whole. When you look underneath, really, you set aside. You open up the kimono of this whole steroids and sports phenomena. What you find is it's all about the future of human enhancement. When you start to look at what's happening in fertility clinics, how people can choose the sex, how they can start to choose certain attributes, it's all about human enhancement. What are hips? I mean, we've got the first cybernetically enhanced vice president in the history of the world. He would not be alive if it wasn't for this bit of technology. He's got more computing in his chest than existed in the entire world before 1970. I mean, you know, people don't realize that the hips that are going in, this is a $50 billion business. Future of medical devices is all about enhancement, giving people greater mobility, giving people more memories. So we're already down that path. For instance, there's 10% of 15% of the folks that are on Prozac are on it to eliminate their anxiety so they can become, they can perform better or be more creative. Again, this is, we're already there. The next generation of this is going to be, Viagra and Cialis are used as lifestyle enhancement drugs. Okay, mm-hmm. I want more pleasure longer. This is the beginning of all of this, the psychopharmacology of pleasure. Okay. So at the end of the day, you're now talking about, and somebody will be working on the next generation of cognoceuticals. We did a report on the neurotech centers on the planet with a group, NeuroNexus, Zach Lynch's group. And you know what? I got to tell you, Art, this is already happening. You combine the breakthroughs in stem cells and neuroscience. Are you going to go someplace for a smart pill treatment? Are you going to go someplace for a device that's going to give you total recall memories, going to give you super mobility? Again, that's a whole other issue between those that are enhanced and those that are not.
While we're on the subject, Doctor, the United States is restricting, for frankly religious reasons, a lot of the baseline research that's going to lead to a lot of these things, and we're sort of crippling ourselves with laws that won't allow U.S. Physicians and scientists to experiment in a lot of these areas. You want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's just wrong. I can comment on it. I've been advising for administrations. I go back to advising, and I'm independent, but I can tell you it's a mistake. This country. Particularly in this administration, has gone ahead and become very anti-science. I think it's ill advice, and it's advice that's not helping the future of the economy and jobs and innovation. And quite frankly, all of our innovations born in the U.S., invested in the U.S., tax dollars at work, have led to prosperity throughout the world. So, and that, of course, helps with, you know, dealing with terrorism and deals with, you know, creating a more collaborative, global, connected world in terms of globalization. So, one, it's a mistake. Two, I think that this current change in leadership in Washington with the Democrats coming in are going to shake up that equation. And I can tell you, whether it's stem cells or the quantum technology or advanced technologies, that I believe that we have turned the corner on this, and it can only get better in terms of our investment. So I'm pleading with, certainly listeners and policymakers that I talk to in government at the highest levels, and, of course, my corporate clients, we're all very concerned in working towards putting science back in on top of the priorities in terms of our agenda, because we've got a brain drain. That's the other part of it.
I know.
You know what's going on around the world. You know, our kids need to embrace science, and they need to be taught by the best scientists. The irony is, and I'm forecasting this, that unfortunately, until this is changed, and I'm hoping it will be changed shortly, you could have American kids that need to go offshore to places like, you know, Singapore and China to get training from professors that were not able to exercise, their work in the United States. So this is just untenable. It's got to change, and it will change.
All right. You have this under the category of weird science, but I guess it's the norm that we discuss on this radio program. Things like teleportation, Multiverses, you know, multiple universes, that sort of theoretical physics that we talk about so much on this program, how close, I mean, are you beginning to feel a little bit of pressure from that sort of fringe area, I hesitate to use that word, but I have to, of science? Is it going to be a breakthrough? Are we going to find another universe? Are we going to figure out how to transport not just a molecule, but perhaps much more from one place to another? That kind of really wild science.
So in this chapter, you're absolutely right. I don't view it as fringe. I view it as speculative. But let me say and forecast this. Yes, we can teleport photons today. We've done that in the past 2 years. The ability to be able to then teleport other kinds of inorganic objects within 8 to 10 years, as far as I'm concerned, is possible. Again, when you think about teleportation, think about it as a basic nanotechnology, the mechanics of nanotechnology, where you are assembling and reassembling matter at the atomic level. As we begin to get better at those tool sets, we'll do that. Now, let's talk about the big picture. And this is, again, speculative science, but it's science. We don't understand the quantum information toolbox that leads to the construction of our universe and every other universe or the metaverse. We don't understand that yet. And there is a raging battle going on in physics right now. The Einsteinians and, of course, the quantum physicists can't both be right about the universe because they're incompatible theories. And superstrings is obviously under attack, and your viewers are familiar with that. But let me pose another challenge, and that is, as we begin to understand the quantum information toolkit, as we begin to understand the laws and the tools, as we're beginning, for instance, to understand with STM equipment, to look into the understanding of how molecules and atoms work with nanotechnology, as we begin to unlock this toolkit, we could then start to validate some of these theories, such as superstrings. I believe that this is still a very immature theory, but let me just say, there is a possibility that your show, for instance, talks to, and there have been other shows as well, that have talked to the notion of there being other kinds of extra-normal intelligences from a variety of other places. They may not be aliens, by the way. They may be echoes or voices from the time-space continuum that actually are reaching out across these multiple universes. So will we find another universe in our lifetime? The probability is yes. Will there be life there? We don't know. Will there be other kinds of intelligence in the universe, given a universe, by the way, that we know that 90% of the universe is, exotic matter, and we don't understand the basic fundamentals, the mystery of life? I think there is a great possibility we will.
Perhaps when we develop a quantum computer. Now, you mentioned Moore's Law earlier. Is Moore's Law holding up? In other words, are we continuing to double, what is it, every 18 months or something? Is that still holding, or is it beginning to fall apart, and will it be replaced by quantum computing at some point?
Well, think about Moore's Law as a metric. Let's just say every year, every technology, every fundamental technology doubles in power, okay? Just every single one. The internet, computing, DNA sequence, just every single computer in every single area, nanobio, IT networks, is doubling in power. At the same time, the cost of that power in general is decreasing by half. Very interesting, right? So there's a cost driver here.
That's now, right.
Are we talking about potentially another paradigm for computing, such as, quantum computing? Yes, we are. And there's actually two companies right now that are working on very hard encryption, and they're actually selling products in the quantum encryption area. So, but I think that quantum computers, what's interesting about them is that they, again, are just the beginnings. They're just a reflection of potential of another whole tool set. That's the application of this quantum information tool set. Yes, I don't believe they represent necessarily an entirely new Moore's Law, if you will, but they're going to provide another tool set for us to be able to perhaps create energy or more secure networks, or maybe to be able to solve some of the vexing problems we have on the planet today. And again, I think it's a very exciting development.
Oh, it is. It is indeed. All right. Dr. James Canton, stay right where you are. We'll be right back. He's a futurist, and we certainly are looking into the future, and the future is certainly approaching quickly, perhaps doubling its speed coming at us every year or so. I'm Art Bell.